Welcome to Everyone's a Critic Movie Review Podcast. I'm your co-host, Bob Zarrell.
Hey, I met you. You are not cool.
With me, as always, is professional film critic Sean Patrick.
I am the smart. S-M-R-T. I mean, S-M-A-R-R-T.
And Josh Adams.
You goddamn communist heathen, you had best sound off that you love the Virgin Mary, or I'm going to stomp your guts out. Now, you do love the Virgin Mary, don't you?
Visit us at IHateCritics.net. We're also at EveryonesCriticPodcast.com, IHateCriticsPodcast.com, IHateCritics.com, a lot of websites. On Facebook, at Everyone's a Critic Podcast. We also have a Facebook group there as well. Follow us there. Join in the conversation. We're also on Twitter and Instagram. Our handle is CriticsPod. All those platforms you can watch or participate in the top fives, watch the trailers, interact with us, read reviews, and just watch us troll each other. We're on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, Spotify. And no matter where you listen to us, please go to Apple Podcasts and subscribe to the show and read your or write a review. We will read the review on the air. We actually have a review from SNick737.
Stevie Nicks?
Or SNick737. Oh. I really love listening to the hosts' reviews and banter. You can tell they are really passionate about film and have a wealth of knowledge to draw from. Give it a listen. So, thank you, SNick737.
Yes, thank you. That was great.
And it's always fun to see what other things these people have reviewed. And he reviewed a game called, or a podcast, his very favorite podcast, is called My Dad Wrote a Porno.
Oh, yeah.
So, I've never heard of that one, but it sounds like it could
I've be. Heard other people talk about that one.
Funny title. But, yeah. So, thank you for the review. And if you write one, we'll read it on the air. Just like that. But now I'm so used to not reading reviews, I'm lost. Where are we supposed to be at? Oh, Patreon. IHateCritics.net/Patreon. The best way to support the podcast and help us grow the show. We are in the midst of setting aside time to record a bonus episode or two. So hopefully that'll be done within the next 2 weeks, give or take. I know I keep saying that, and it's been like 6 months, but it'll happen, I promise. But that's the best way to help out the podcast, IHateCritics.net/Patreon. All right, news. We'll start with, I guess, say Star Wars is changing. They're flip-flopping back and forth all week long. First, we did our big show where we talked about all the 9 movies they were going to release. Then they announced that we're not going to do the Obi-Wan and Boba Fett movie. And now apparently they're changing it again. What's going on?
There's talk now that they may go ahead and try to do these movies that they had said that possibly they were canceling. People keep pushing the notion of Solo as a failure, but it's done over $200 million just in the U.S. And I don't know how it's doing internationally, but
I don't think it was doing well. That was the big reason they were calling it a failure, is it didn't do well over internationally. That's what we talked about that week, right?
Yeah, that's right. The other thing, too, is I've heard a couple of different things this week. Number one, that with their streaming service debuting next year, they may actually push for the Obi-Wan film to debut on that.
Well, that doesn't count.
Of course it counts, though.
Turns
would
a
you
TV
say,
show.
No, you know just as well as I do, though, if you found something to be serious on Netflix, you would treat it just like a theatrical release in terms of importance, because if it's a good movie, it's a good movie, right?
Yes and no. I guess yes in terms of a movie like Kodachrome, a movie. But when it comes to a blockbuster action movie, I would say no.
Bob wants blockbusters to spend correctly, okay? But when they try and go to the streaming service to make sure that it's profitable.
It ceases to be a blockbuster at that point. Now it's just a movie.
Okay, Bob wants movies to spend their money correctly, but then when it tries
I'm saying it just the effect of it being it's no longer this huge blockbuster movie. It's all right, we can't do it. Here it is.
I'm with you on that. And honestly, I'm saying that just that to troll you poorly, I might add. But
answer for everything.
Of course you do. The real part about this, though, it actually does kind of bother me. I mean, the prestige of Star Wars is still matters.
That's
to
kind
me,
of what know? I mean. It's not everything you're saying is right in terms of when you're trolling me. I agree with that. But the prestige and the blockbuster quality, or I don't know, quality is not the word, but. Prestige is the word that it just now it's straight to streaming. And
yeah, you could argue Star Wars made the modern theater, so to speak. You go to theater to see something like Star Wars on the big screen, and if it's relegated to the smaller screen, then that means you've kind of lost this particular battle with the franchise a little bit. Then again, Lucasfilm has said that they're kind of looking at a different strategy going forward. Episode 9 is still in pre-production and script is done and whatnot. I heard a small rumor also read from legitimate sources. I'm not just going to the ends of the internet to find these things, but that Obi-Wan may secretly shoot scenes for Ewan McGregor may secretly shoot scenes for Episode 9. And that presents a very interesting thing there, that he would literally be taking over for Alec Guinness and they would age him to look like a force ghost, you know, so that's kind of neat.
you want the best Star Wars news of the week, you're gonna love this one. And this is not confirmed, this is just a rumor that's been happening that I've been seeing on Twitter, but apparently the remake of The Last Jedi, and I mean,
I saw this,
has raised $149 million.
Yes, and I love Rian Johnson's response to this.
Please
make this.
Have you seen Seth Rogen's response?
No.
Seth Rogen's has been amazing. He's like, I don't get it. You got people who are going to give you $150 million to a property you don't own. And, you know, and then their response was, yes, blah, blah, blah. And then he's like, okay, but please explain to me. And he just kept repeating the tweet, but he would just, okay, I got that, but explain to me this part. You have yet to do that. You don't, how do you, who's going to give you $150 million to make something you don't own?
But it's not a remake. It's a redo. You couldn't even call it The Last Jedi. Yeah. They don't want to remake that movie.
We're going to remake this movie without Kelly Marie Tran if it kills us all.
That's right. Oh, we can get Mark Hamill because he said that's not his Luke Skywalker. Bullshit. This is the worst fans.
These are the worst fans. These are the people you hate, Bob. And we have to agree.
But here's what I think is funny is if, in fact, the Obi-Wan movie goes to streaming or doesn't come out at all and the Boba Fett seems to be dead, they did this by boycotting Solo. And I think that's awesome. Because they deserve that.
The Star Wars fandom is eating itself.
The idiots that even you hate.
Yeah.
It's affecting you, but...
Yeah. I mean, you know that I'm going to be there at the first showing or the premiere of whatever it is that they do. So I still have faith in the storytellers.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. When Rian Johnson made that movie, it was not just a good movie to me. It was like, wow, they really cared to advance this in a different direction in some ways.
Or just advance.
Yeah, it was definitely something different, and I didn't mind. I still felt like it was a Star Wars movie, and it just it rubs me the wrong way that there's so many peers that would want to do that.
It's such incredible nonsense.
Yeah.
It really is. What are you so mad about? Really, what are you so mad about? I love Star Wars. I don't get what everybody's so upset about. Not just because I liked The Last Jedi. I just don't understand this level of ridiculous idiot commitment to something this nonsensical.
Yeah, and if that's not your Star Wars, if The Last Jedi is not your Luke Skywalker, you have... It's almost limitless, the avenues that you can go down to find different content that's post Return of the Jedi, if that's what you really want. But if you are saying, well, this movie didn't do what I wanted it to do, you literally have like thousands of things to read, watch, whatever after Return of the Jedi. It's silly.
We all have movies that didn't do what we wanted it to do. I think we're going to talk about one later. But
indeed.
But to go out and just, I don't know, the way they're reacting,
throw your money away.
It's just stupid. I would like to know where they got the $150 million that they clearly don't have or whatever.
Yeah, I don't buy that money actually exists somewhere.
And then, and more nerd news, Linda Hamilton's coming back to try to save a franchise she won't save.
Well, probably not, no, but man, that was an awesome photo. That was it's Sarah Connor. It's one of the... I rewatched Terminator and Terminator 2 this past weekend because I just couldn't help myself, and finally watching with somebody that really understands the thoughts and theories behind time travel as well. And boy, it was I couldn't possibly have been more excited to get back into the Terminator world and think of Linda Hamilton and how committed that performance is compared to the breadth of her entire career. It's just so cool to see her again. I understand that they're asking us to probably forget third, fourth, fifth film. My lady decides to step in and say, oh, well, it could just be like 2009 Star Trek and that they're playing with time travel and you've created a divergent timeline. But I would point, as I told her, I would point her towards the article that Cameron and Tim Miller have said, no, we're not, we're making this as a direct sequel to Terminator 2. They are ignoring 3, 4, 5. Fine. Okay. It's too bad. I invested a little bit in those, but...
It's okay, because they were all terrible.
I disagree. but Terminator Genisys is one of the largest pieces of garbage I've ever seen. I would agree with that. It was akin to A Good Day to Die Hard, or whatever that piece of garbage was. But 3 and 4 have parts of it that are like, oh, all right.
That's the best part about Josh, is he'll find parts that he likes. He doesn't have to like the whole thing to...
I know. I can make my own movie in my head, just like The Last Jedi detractors should do. They should make their own movie.
Unless there's dinosaurs or devils in it.
Touché, senor. Touché.
We did a dinosaur devil movie starring James Franco.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
As a gangster.
That he just doesn't have to see as a gangster.
I've come down on my James Franco tirade. You know, it was the favorite
Fine,
movie
Owen
of
Wilson.
Mine. All right, I can get behind that.
And it has to be good.
Good luck.
Everybody else has to like it.
I think I described an accidental remake of Carnosaur.
I was going to say, if you wanted a devil dinosaur in this film we're going to talk about, there's Dinosaur with Horns.
Kind of, yeah. Yeah. And then we'll have to, maybe one of the bonus episodes, we can discuss time travel in movies. A little more.
That actually sounds like a great idea. Shelve that.
Oh, that's what I'm doing. It's shelved right now.
All right.
Maybe we can do two bonus podcasts next week or in a couple weeks or whenever.
Ooh,
we do.
I could really get into that.
Especially since it requires no work other than talking. And then, because we don't have many movies to talk about this week, we've talked about it before. MoviePass has sent us all an email saying we're making changes. Preferred seating, preferred movies, preferred times. I don't know. Different. I can't even remember.
Well, basically, the idea is what Uber did, which is the surge pricing, where if there's a movie that's very popular, the price of your movie pass will essentially go up to match that price, or the availability of tickets will go down based on the amount of people that are trying to see it at the same time, and you'll have to. If you want to go see it on your movie pass, you'll need to see it on an off time so you can actually get a ticket with your movie pass. Which is, wow, that sucks.
Well, you can
trying to go opening weekend.
Well,
you just buy the biggest package and maybe you can get that.
Well, no, you just have to pay like an additional $3 or something like that, They would add on to the price, which I still think is a good deal and probably the right move, whether movie pass lasts or not. This is going to happen. Somebody is going to come in. I know, I think Cinemark's doing it already.
AMC debuted their $20 a month plan, and it has rules.
And I think no matter what, there's going to be some sort of, you know, on-demand, or on-demand is not the right word, but a subscription-based theater. That's not going to go away. Whether it's MoviePass or not, I don't know, but it's not going away. I know you don't like it, right?
Of course I don't. They have more emails about we're changing things around than Sears does, and they're almost on the brink of extinction. I mean, I get emails from Sears twice a day saying, oh, you haven't claimed your prize, you know, come get our bankrupt stuff. The MoviePass thing, I understand that to stay salient as a company, they have to do certain things like this, and I can't argue with on that. It'd be silly to argue with you on that, but the surge pricing thing is always going to piss me off. I mean, I have a limited amount of time to see something between Thursday and Sunday, generally, when we get together. There is no, I'm seeing it Wednesday of the following opening, you know?
Right.
I'm just going to tell MoviePass to blow itself and I'll pay full price. They won't care, but they would lose a subscription.
But, I mean, it's not, you still get to see it. You just got to pay an additional $3 out of
I do Patreon. Understand in a way that still makes it work, but I don't like theaters or programs involving films telling me what to do. I mean, the telling me where to sit, telling me what time I have to see something, no 3D, no IMAX,
but cool thing, they are adding 3D and IMAX.
Yes.
And for the theaters where you assign seating, they're allowing you to bring someone on to buy with, I mean, you can pay for it in one instead of doing two different transactions. So there are neat things in the pipeline. Whether it works or not, who knows? But I don't know. I'm glad they're at least trying to stick around.
This pyramid scheme will come tumbling down eventually, but right now it's working.
Well, I don't think the scheme's for them. It's coming down, but I think the subscription base is here to stay.
I agree. I think if nothing else, what they've done is forced the hand of theater chains to say, like, well, we probably need to offer different things to our consumers.
All right, should we talk about movies now? Or no, trailers. I forgot about those.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't actually watch the one. I'm sorry. I was totally busy.
It was a last minute thing, but the most important one.
The Hate U Give. I was in the process of thinking about saying that word that trailer before you segued to Creed 2. Well, let's go ahead and start with The Hate U Give anyway.
Yeah, this is a trailer that popped up in my promotions folder in my email today from Regal saying, watch the new trailer for this. And other than Common and I think Regina Hall, I can't recognize the names of most of the actors involved in this project. But the film tells us that there is a high school-aged girl who is very good friends and may have a relationship with someone else at her. It is a local school. They're stopped by officers, white officers. He goes for a comb. They blow him away. This is in the trailer. And how the community, which appears to be predominantly African-American, how they deal with this particular issue is what the film's about. Obviously, it's a hot-button topic, but at the same time, I think what matters about this is that they're actually doing that. Of all of the stuff that's going on, I guess you could say, in the world, there's not a whole lot that actually confronts something head-on. There's a historical story, Black Klansman, that's going to come out that we've talked about before, but this one is really topical, and I'm very interested in it. It's a powerful trailer. And it's not, it doesn't appear to me to be something of a gimmick. It appears that everyone involved in this project is taking it seriously. Like, how far do you go with your distrust to the point where it comes back on you? Thus the title.
Yeah, I agree, but I think it's going to come off as a gimmick. You know, I think everybody involved there's no gimmick involved in the making of it, but I think, you know, it's definitely preaching to the choir. They're doing their best to make it so maybe it won't preach to the choir. And I don't know. She comes from a white school, and, you know, she's definitely a different person during the day than she is at night.
Mm-hmm.
And they're doing I appreciate the effort, and I know what they're trying to do. And it's going to be, I think it's going to be good. I think it's going to end up being a preach to the choir type movie, which unfortunately bums me out a little bit. But
yes, it does.
But that's not necessarily on them either. And then Creed 2. Maybe we should have started with this.
Oh, man. Yeah. I don't know about this one, man. I'm a little bit leery now after this. Building up to Drago like he's Jaws. Like, really? Oh, boy. I don't know, man. I was in before this trailer. Ooh, this makes it look a lot like something Stallone would be happy with, and that worries me a lot.
Yeah.
It's not Ryan Coogler directing this, so that's a major.
You don't say. Step down. or writing it,
but Michael B. Jordan, he just continues to impress me every time I see him, even in projects that are not reviewed well, like Fantastic Four, for example. I still appreciated him in that. Everything that I've seen him in, he's just so charismatic that I'm drawn to his performances. And gosh, I think the whole thing looks very typical. It's almost exactly what I expected out of the trailer, to be honest. But man, I don't care. I can't wait to see this movie.
That's kind of that's the point. I think it's, as soon as I started announcing what this was, it's like, okay, I'm not, this isn't Creed or Rocky. This is Rocky 3 or Rocky 4, oh, maybe. Yeah. Now, if he can make it that entertaining, mixed with nostalgia, then I'm in. I mean, building it up like you with Jaws had the theater going nuts that I was in. So it clearly worked. I knew it was coming because I knew all that. I think we all knew it was coming because it's been news.
Oh, yeah.
But everybody in the theater was just like, all of a sudden it started buzzing a little bit, which is kind of cool to see. But I'm not, for even half a second, expecting it to be even on close to the level of Creed. I'm just hoping for fun at this point.
I got it.
Okay, the part in the trailer where he says this is means something more than I instantly thought. Stallone thinks that Rocky IV was really integral in the fall of the Cold War, wasn't he? He really thinks that's important, right? And he really thinks that he's going to have something to say about the current relations between our two countries, isn't he?
Wait,
that's
a minute.
Really cute.
Are you trying to say that Rocky IV didn't end the Cold War?
Well, it's a stretch.
What about the scene where he punched the Iron Curtain and it fell down?
Well, isn't that what happened? Like, somebody punched the Berlin Wall and it fell down.
That's what was in my history book. I don't know.
I mean, there's only 5 years between the movie and the actual fall of the Berlin Wall, but still.
To be fair, is it really over?
No.
It just went quiet for a little bit. It's like the Gulf War. But yeah, hopefully it's fun. That's all I can ask for. Hopefully he doesn't die like his dad. I don't know why I said that.
That would not be a fun ending.
Maybe he'll fight him first and then Rocky will die. I don't know.
Well, I mean, that's the arc of Burgess Meredith's character, right? Was that death in the second film as the trainer. As Mickey's death was in the third movie.
Yeah.
I can't tell him apart anymore.
If you watch him, you can't. But yeah, it's hopefully it's enough, at least fun. That's all I can ask for at this point. Jurassic World, Fallen Kingdom.
Yeah, Jurassic World, Fallen Kingdom, directed by J.A. Bayona, the director of A Monster Calls and the Orphanage. This is picking up the story of Jurassic World. I'm not sure exactly how long after the first one, but Bryce Dallas Howard's character and Chris Pratt's character aren't together as they were seemingly at the end of the first film. She's now a dinosaur rights activist trying to save the dinosaurs.
I let it go.
I haven't heard it out loud yet. The dinosaur rights activist.
Dinosaur rights activist. She's trying to rescue the dinosaurs on Isla Nublar that are going to die because of this volcano on the island. And she wants Congress to rescue them. They say no. She takes a meeting with this billionaire played by James Cromwell, who apparently was the best friend of the
other old guy.
Richard Attenborough character from the John first Hammond. Film, John Hammond, and he was his partner. They split up for reasons. He's now wants to try and get the dinosaurs saved. He's got a Weasley assistant played by Rafe Spall who's trying to put this together. Obviously, he's the villain who's going to try and steal the dinosaurs and use them for weapons or whatever. And basically, it's all about getting the dinosaurs from the island to this cool house, this cool mansion somewhere in America. And I don't love this movie, but I don't think it's that bad. Honestly, that's certainly not as bad as many critics said it was. I thought there are moments in this movie that are actually kind of fun, creepy. Especially the stuff where they're running around the house. That house is really cool. That mansion is like a really cool museum library. I really liked the way he shot that. I really liked the way it looked. Bayona is a terrific visual eye, and I thought a lot of the way he shot that house was really fantastic. The upper part that looks like a library museum, and then the bottom portion, which is this military organization / lab that where they're holding the dinosaurs. I thought all that was cool. The parts that I didn't like are actually like the Bryce Dallas Howard and Chris Pratt. They're only kind of okay, really. Chris Pratt's still playing that same Chris Pratt character. Bryce Dallas Howard isn't given much to do. She kind of they intentionally like take her out of the movie for a little while because like, well, we don't really have anything for you right now, so we're just gonna stick a dinosaur fingernail through your leg and you're just gonna sit there for a while until you come back and near the end. So there's stuff that doesn't work. The whole subplot about the little girl, I don't even know what was going on with that. I don't really care. I think it just seems like that's more part of like some other sequel that they're going to do, I guess.
If it's not, it's totally pointless.
So I'm assuming that's what that's for. It didn't really matter to me at all watching this movie, although I did like her as an actress. I liked the way she was the way they use her. I mean, the child in danger plots don't usually work for me, but she was so good at her terror that I was invested. And that scene with her in the bedroom trying to hide from the dinosaurs, legitimately creepy. I liked that. So this is a far from great movie, but I enjoyed enough elements of this to say that I kind of recommend this.
This is so stupid. There's a level of stupid that I'm willing to accept. And as stupid as Jurassic World was for me, that is like leaps and bounds way more fun than this is. So things escape and there are icky people and there are good people. And it's the same formula played to the nth degree. And I don't care. Chris Pratt is bored. I thought it was not just him playing Chris Pratt. He doesn't have anything behind his performance. And at least Bryce Dallas Howard's like, I'm an activist now. I'm PETA for dinosaurs. Well, I bet they're probably delicious, too. But we didn't go there. I would eat T-Rex steak. It could be the old 96er. Like a T-Rex. Yeah. This movie doesn't have anything to offer that's new other than the thought that that technology that they've worked with for dinosaurs, where else are they going to apply that to? And that's necessary for one of the subplots of the film. Fine. But then it stops and then they don't talk about it for the rest of the film. It's a mess. And it's not, I don't think at all, it's J.A. Bayona's fault because as you stated, he's very good at interiors. A Monster Calls, part of that film's effectiveness for me is the way that they filmed the house that the boy is in and the house that the mom that's sick is in. He's very good at that, but what he doesn't do well for me is action. There are a lot of pregnant pauses and nothing to do scenes in Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom. Like, How are you having dead time in the summer's largest blockbuster, so to speak? But all in all, my son liked it. He said that was great. I think I really disappointed him. He actually had, I love my boy, but he had tears in his eyes when I told him, like, it's starting to form when I said no. He asked me, like, that was awesome. Did you like it? No, I'm sorry. He said, why? And he didn't understand that he can have his own thing and I can have my own thing and everyone else can have their thing too. It's a good teachable moment.
He didn't understand that his dad is a joyless monster.
It wasn't in space, so.
All right, so you do that.
Dinosaurs in space.
Dinosaurs in space. At least it's a new angle, okay, other than dinosaurs get out. But all I can say is
get out.
You know, there's. My boy keeps telling me, like, but the Indoraptor was so cool, and all I can think of is a raptor smoking a doobie. That's the Indoraptor to me. All I can think of is creating some meme for this movie. That's its value to me, is somehow photoshopping a blunt into the raptor's mouth. I have no use for this movie at all. It is so terrible.
Pretty sure someone sent me a picture of a dinosaur smoking some.
That's fantastic.
I don't have a, it's fine. It's not as good as the first one, fourth one, whatever we're calling it. It's the first Jurassic World was a kind of a scary monster movie. This one had moments. I don't blame the director because I think it's him trying to be successful, and it's successful, so he's going to get to do more things that maybe he has more control over. But it definitely, there's a lot of silliness to it, to the point where I kind of had rampage fun with the silliness of it because of the way, at least, they weren't trying that hard, but just the dinosaur rights activist, that is kind of funny. And so it's, but it wasn't, like Rampage, that was a consistent theme throughout the whole movie. Every actor was in on it. To me, I just kind of thought Bryce Dallas Howard and a little bit of Chris Pratt were in on it. Everybody else was. And maybe the bad guy. But then there would be the good tense scenes. It was definitely a lot of movies in one with a lot of pointless subplots. Not just the one about the girl, but it just seemed to... I don't know. It just... And it, your point about the action, there wasn't a lot of it. There was them running off the island. There's a little action there, I guess. And then the very end when the dinosaurs got loose during the auction. That's about it. Everything else was just kind of a... Not even a slow build, just kind of a... I guess there's a few cool moments. Them trying to draw blood from a T-Rex. Which, again, is kind of stupid. I don't know. It was what it was. I'm fine with it. I didn't dislike it, but I didn't love it either.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I mean, this is far from great, but it was good enough. And I guess I don't think I had any high expectations based off of Jurassic World, which was good. Good movie. I didn't have high expectations going into this, and so it met my lowest possible expectations. I had a good enough time at this. I had more fun at this than I did Rampage, which I just didn't enjoy. But this one had a couple of moments that I was kind of like, yeah, that's cool. Yeah, that's cool. I like the production design. I think he's a terrific director, and I think artistry can go a long way to making something that isn't great a little bit better. Hmm.
Do you mind if I add another moment to this? Let's consider the principals involved in this. Their depth of involvement, I'm not sure of. We don't really know. But from executive producer Steven Spielberg, Frank Marshall, Colin Trevorrow, and director Jay Bayona comes a pile of shit. I can't accept something for... Well, it's fun, but when you have that much like talent involved, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Why would they settle for just something this stupid? And well, it's a popcorn movie. You get to see dinosaurs, blah, 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 blah. I even put Jurassic Park, the first one, on a lower pedestal than other Spielberg movies because he didn't take what was in a lot of what was in the book and put it in the movie. He opted for the popcorn a lot of the time, and that was disappointing. Why? Just because kids like dinos and they feel that there's a lot of money involved in that? And that's just a poor creative choice to me. And that's why I'm saying it's not the movie that I want it to be. Yes, because the movie I want it to be actually takes this seriously and takes the ideas of genetic engineering and our footprint on this planet and whatnot seriously. Jeff Goldblum is in this movie as Ian Malcolm again. And he is... That's not Ian Malcolm. He's just reading a couple of lines and collecting whatever extra paycheck he did for showing up on screen here. It just really bugs me that they don't care, it seems.
because this is not even on the same stratospheric level as Jurassic Park, which is not a perfect movie. They're completely different franchises. Just because there's dinosaurs involved doesn't mean they're the same quality of movie, even. That's just very disappointing.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, because I read the book, too. When I saw Jurassic Park, I was just like, you started on, like, page 80.
Yep.
You missed all this cool stuff and just went for that. And I actually didn't like it that much because of that. Over the years, I've gone back and accepted it for what it is. And because it's in the same world, I have a harder time being as hard on the Jurassic World movies. I think they're better than Lost World, Jurassic Park 3, and if there's another one after that, I don't know. But I do think these two are better than those two. But I've just kind of come to accept the fact that we're in this world, and I think they care about being financially successful, and that's where their focus is. And you know, you get a good director to take a pile of shit, let's say, and polish it a little bit and make a little money. And that's basically what happened.
It's just an empty enterprise for me, almost on the Transformers level of empty enterprise, where you have something you could actually take the source material and deal with it in a professional, creative manner, and they just don't care.
I'll watch this 50 times before I see another Transformers movie. I hate the Transformers far more than this.
There's definitely some hate going on with me, too, but at least I have expectations that are, like, really low for Transformers movies. I would... Bumblebee's trailer is better than this movie.
That's funny. Yeah, I don't know. I feel like the fact that it could be something, and again, you'd have to start over, and it would if that great movie you're talking about, people aren't gonna like we would, you know, and that's what's frustrating, because you can't do it for cheap, you know. It's just one of those. I don't know.
I think I see what you're saying. You can't make a rated R dinosaur movie, which is really what would happen, what nature would allow to happen, you know, is a rated R film. And you can't do that in
Be Salient. And you can't do it for under $30,000 or $30 million.
Of course.
You'd have to spend the same budget.
Otherwise, you'd get Carnosaur.
But you could do Batman at $30-40 million and make it work. Because, you know, he's a person. He's put him in a suit. You don't got to CGI him.
Of course. I understand what you mean.
But, yeah, Jurassic World, Fallen Kingdom. It's hard to keep talking about it. We're trying, though. We'll sit on our top five to the classic. Catcher Was a Spy.
Yes, The Catcher Was a Spy is a true story about a guy named Mo Berg, who in the late 1920s and 30s, he was a catcher for the Boston Red Sox. He was also a guy who could speak a dozen languages. He was a graduate of Princeton, super genius, essentially. And once his baseball career ends, he's looking for a job, and he gets a job with the OSS during World War II. The OSS is the predecessor of the CIA, and he's recruited there to go to Germany with the job of trying to figure out where the Germans are on making a bomb. And he is going to be tasked with trying to kill Germany's top scientist, this guy Heisenberg. And the plot plays out whether or not he's going to be able to figure out if this guy is helping or hurting the German cause, and if indeed he is trying to help build the atomic bomb, he's got to kill him. This movie's really good. It's got terrible reviews. It's only at 34% on Rotten Tomatoes, but I thought it was pretty fantastic. Paul Rudd is really great. He's very engaging. He really captures how unknowable Mo Berg was in real life, because really when you hear about Mo Berg, nobody really knew him. He was a very secretive guy. There's a whole plot about him perhaps having been gay and keeping that side of his life almost completely hidden, aside from a couple of instances where people may have spotted him in various nightclubs. He was a guy who, after this, with all of that training, with all that education, with all of that specialized knowledge, after World War II, he goes to just becoming a bum. He's just couch surfing the rest of his life, from family member to family member. It's bizarre why he doesn't use his skills to do something. But he's a fascinating character, and he's unknowable, and Paul Rudd captures that rather brilliantly. And I think people fault this movie because he's not this super charismatic, dashing type guy. He's a guy who is a spy who did actual spy work. He went to, he was deceptive, but he was more perceptible than anything. He was just very, very perceptive of people. He knew people. He understood people. And that was his real talent as a spy, was figuring out people's motivations. And not just being just some over-the-top caricature, like a nonviolent James Bond. That's not what this is. That's not what real spies do. Real spies just really are people who gather information better than other people. And that's what Mo Berg did. He gathers information better than other people. And I think in that reality of it, and the way this plays out, and there's some serious tension near the end where if you didn't already know the history of Heisenberg and what he goes on to be, there's some tension there of what's going to happen. I love the scene. Mark Strong plays Heisenberg, and they have a great scene at the end. There's a number of really great scenes throughout this movie, and I think this movie's far better than people are giving it credit for. I think people go into a spy movie expecting everybody to be James Bond, and when you don't get James Bond, you're kind of going, oh, well, that wasn't fun.
Yeah, I'm reading some of the reviews now. Bland is a lot of the words. A couple of people are calling it inconsistent. But you know who did like it? Your buddy Rex Reed. He also didn't like Hereditary, so. Gotta get that shot in there.
There you go. Well done.
He's still a dope, yeah.
Yeah, Zendog.
Zendog, yes. This stars Kyle Gallner. He's from the TV series Shameless. He stars here as sort of kind of two different characters. There's one character who, when he's awake, he's this guy who works at a company that he's creating where he's trying to create virtual reality tours of various places around the world that he's never been to. He's got a routine that he does every single day. He's got a thing that happens at every time, at a specific time every single day. His routine gets messed up when his friend, played by Adam Hirschman, comes to stay with him and starts messing up his life. Meanwhile, he's having these weird nightmares that keep waking him up in the middle of the night. And when his friend sees him having one of these nightmares, he decides to give him this strange sort of herbal tea that is laced with some kind of drug. And this leads him into the area of lucid dreaming, where he's able to control what happens in his dream. And then this leads him off on a road trip in his dreams. So he takes this tea, and every night he's continuing to this story of this road trip where he's going across the country. He's driving this really unusual car. He's got this really weird and unusual coat. He meets this this dream girl, this French dream girl. He's going to travel across the country with him, and they're going to have a love story. And this is all filmed in kind of like that sort of dreamy sort of Terrence Malick kind of way. And I was really fascinated by this movie. It's a movie about feel. It's a movie about cinematography and artistry and just exploration of the mind. And I really dug this movie. It's a strange movie. It's not going to be for everybody. Some people are going to say it doesn't have a story or that it's just kind of too long or nothing's happening. If you have a attention span problem, you probably might not go for this movie. But the cinematography here, this is by a guy who used to be a cinematographer, so he pays a great deal of attention to the detail of the way the movie looks. And so you've got one kind of grayscale sort of looking side when he's awake, and then his dreams are very beautiful, and the picture is very crisp and beautiful and colorful. And the ways that works is just brilliant. The color of the film is fantastic. The artistry gets me past any kind of reservations I have about any kind of lack in the story. I really like this movie a lot.
Where do you see it?
It is actually available now on demand. You can actually rent it on any of the on-demand services now.
It goes to show I should do a little bit of research, even the films I haven't seen, because Zendog, I was thinking to myself, some sort of animated film involving a dog.
That was Rock Dog. That's
I was thinking the same thing, though. Even based on the, like, I didn't pull the picture up, but watching it from a little thumbnail on the computer, it looked almost animated. So. Yeah, but I like that kid from Shameless, so.
He's really good. He's got a really interesting face. Like, yeah. And the way that they use his hair and his facials in this movie also work, because he almost creates an entirely different person in the dream from when he's awake.
Ladies and gentlemen, This is the main event for the linear, legitimate, and universally recognized Undisputed
Classic.
Our Undisputed Classic this week is Cujo.
Yeah, and then we're thinking of like monster movies to go with Jurassic World, and obviously the first one we all thought of was Jaws, but with The Meg coming out later this year, you figure you got to save Jaws for that. So
we've been saving Jaws over and over again, unless you can find something else to save it for.
it's the Matt Damon of this podcast. Jaws will be with us next week.
You have to wait for a Patreon bonus episode.
But so we're trying to think of monsters and unusual monsters, and I think Cujo is a monster. It's a monster movie far more than even is a dog movie. The idea here is that this family that's kind of in turmoil, they simply want to get their car fixed, and they go to this out-of-town guy who's an amateur mechanic who has a dog, and the dog is Cujo. And the first thing you see in the movie is Cujo's chasing a rabbit and chases this rabbit down a hole, and inside the hole are bats. And the bats start flying around, and one of them bites Cujo on the nose, and now he's rabid. And it's basically just waiting then. The tension just starts building from that moment to when Cujo's going to flip out, go crazy, and start going, you know, rabid on everybody. And it takes 45 minutes before you actually get to the first kill. And I was kind of bored. I was not investing in the whole family drama. I like Dee Wallace. She's a good actress, but I was not really particularly invested. But anytime Cujo came on screen, I got a little tense. I kind of started gripping a little bit every time Cujo came on the screen. And little kids are going up to Cujo. And then they're establishing like the cannon fodder characters that you know Cujo's going to kill. And every time I saw Cujo, I would get a little bit more nervous and a little bit more excited. And as the movie goes on, once Dee Wallace and her son are in their Pinto and they arrive at the farm and there's nobody else around and just Cujo there, that series of scenes is filled with a great deal of tension and well-played tension. Lewis Teague does a pretty good job of using the camera from Cujo's perspective to create some scary situations. And I was surprised at how skillful that was, because I don't necessarily think Teague is a great director based off of the rest of what he's done, which is not much. But this movie, he's very smart in the way he plays that. You're in that situation where you're very much identifying with Dee Wallace's character and trying to figure out, well, what could you do? I mean, if you get bit, you're going to get rabies, and that's going to be even, you know, that's all going to be bad. You're going to die. She's dead from like very early on. It seems like she just has no chance whatsoever. And that tension combined with the tension of when will somebody realize that she's missing and when will somebody think of where to go to find her? Well played. Is this movie great? No, but from a genre standpoint, from a B-movie standpoint, this is a hell of a movie.
Oh, yeah. My experience with Cujo is watching it as a 12 going on 13-year-old, really thick into the world of Stephen King and trying to read everything from the beginning up till the present, and I got a lot of it in.
You've read this one?
Yes.
I have questions when you're done.
Okay. The film itself, I agree with you. It's not great, but in terms of the consistency from minute 45 to minute 90, that's good stuff right there. Everything that is done with the actual dog is really incredible. I think acting as a dog or directing a dog or an animal of any sort has got to be difficult, even if they're well-trained, because you're looking for a particular reaction out of them, and you've got to instill that in them based off of what they're able to do and what they're already trained to do. In this case, you've got a dog that has to look crazy, and that's really hard to pull off. And everything that they, I wonder how much film made it onto the cutting room floor for this film, because every scene that he's on screen, he's scary. Even when he's fluffy and soft and cute, it's still like, oh, that's a large dog. But once you get to him attacking this Pinto, and everything that's flying off of him, the foaming of the mouth, the blood, and the staining of that car and the windows and everything. Most films that are horror-based, there's a lot of splatter. There's a lot of viscera, per se. And in this particular one, this is like, it's far more realistic to me.
Yeah.
what happens in this film because it's like caked on there. And whenever I think of scenes involving any kind of natural terror, be it a car accident or you're in a hospital or something like that, that's what you see. And this film has it. It's creepy to watch as this dog goes around the car and it's caked with blood and whatever's coming out of his brain, you know. Danny Pintauro is giving a pretty decent performance here upon minute 45 right on. He's pretty annoying before that, like most other child actors, but he seems genuinely terrified. And I fear for Danny Pintauro. He's alive. He's not a child actor that, you know, went down like a really dark hole, say like Edward Furlong. But I can't imagine having to scream like that and be that terrified even as a child. That's a hell of a performance. And he's really young in this film, you know? And then with him stopping breathing or whatnot, all of a sudden, the first time that I saw this, I'm like, yeah, that would suck. But now I'm like, oh, there's a kid involved. All of a sudden, my brain turns to a different direction, right, and it becomes that much more terrifying and claustrophobic. And it reminds me of zombie films in which you're kind of like, no one's anywhere for miles on end. Nothing is going to stop. And you kind of just want her to sprint for that door no matter what happens, and it just never does. So the tension, this is 45 minutes of a great movie. The other part of it becomes like unnecessary subplots that we don't really need. The book is smarter in that it's weaving in stories of this, you know, extracurricular ad campaign or whatever, the turmoil of the marriage or whatever. It all seems to be like karma-based in a way. Cujo is a monster, yes, but it's like the monster that everyone seems to deserve in the book. And there's something that happens at the end of the book versus what happens at the end of the movie that makes the book 50 times better and was far more memorable for me. When I saw the movie, I was so disappointed in the ending that I will always say the book is landmark compared to this.
See, I haven't read the book. I was watching some special features, and they were saying that in the book it's a supernatural, like a reincarnated dog. If that is the case, then fuck you. That's the stupidest thing I've ever heard in my life.
I don't remember anything about supernatural.
Is it reincarnated? Book.
Or reincarnated. Okay. I don't remember anything about that.
But Stephen King also wrote the original draft of the movie, the movie, which they said was way too away from the book. So maybe that's what they were talking about. So if that's not the case, then
no.
Good. Because that was just the dumbest thing I'd ever heard in my life. And I was like, why would you make the dog supernatural? It's scarier when it's real.
Yeah, all I remember is dog terrorizing car. Dog That's terrorizing good. Kid and mom.
It must have been the screenplay you wrote originally.
I believe that. But if you haven't read the book, I encourage you, not just you, but anyone listening, I encourage you to do that. It's hard when you know that there's a particular ending that hits hard, and then the film kind of pushes out, and that's what happens, and I won't say anything else.
No, for me, it's... You know, I kind of forget about that first 45 minutes. We haven't measured it out. We're just saying it for the sake of...
Oh, I think you're absolutely right, though. It is like the 45-minute mark where...
Josh has measured it out.
I did clock that first kill at 45 minutes in because I stopped the movie for a moment just to see where we were.
Okay, I did not clock it at all because I don't do that. But unless it's a nude scene. That's not true.
High-speed scrubbing.
But... It almost, like, the first time I watched it, I think I just had a kid, or it was maybe before, right around then. And, you know, from that angle, that phone booth part of the movie, where it's just them in the car, more or less, is just absolutely terrifying and suspenseful. And not many movies have been able to accomplish that level of terror and suspense on that level. To the point where I don't even care about the movie as a whole. I just kind of... That is the movie to me, and I forget about everything else, not meaning to until this time when it was just... I had a hard time getting into it until it got there again. But now I remember that more, which kind of definitely hurts the movie.
the realistic, like the grossness, you know, the sweat and the,
right.
and the terror and the screaming and the dog with the blood and the pus and the mud and all that stuff coming off of him is genuinely like that is so incredible. I worry at the level of detail that they got out of that dog. Right. Like, what did you do to get that dog to do that? Like, that did worry me a little bit. I don't really want to look into the history of Cujo just so it doesn't destroy that for me. Because something horrible happened to everybody who was involved in this movie, I would assume, based off of just how real all that felt.
They let the dog read the script to Beethoven and said, this one.
Well, you know, the dog in Beethoven's name is Cujo.
Right.
Okay, I didn't know if you were aware of that or not. But
I thought the dog's name was Beethoven.
What? Like, you know, in the cast listing, like, you know what I'm talking about. But that used to be a thing with parents and friends of parents or whatever. If you had a really, like, dark humor parent or, you know, friend's parent or whatever that had a cat named Cujo or a dog named Cujo, it was like, oh, you guys are dark. I like this.
But usually what it's like a little tiny-ass annoying dog the name Cujo.
Right, right.
We just got a little tiny dog. I thought about it, but no.
Where the hell does the name Cujo come from?
Stephen King.
What do you even think? What's the origin of that? That's such a... I mean, I guess it's an intimidating name, I guess.
I remember reading something about this at one point, and it may have been the name of a pet from Stephen King's youth. I'll have to check and see if my intuition is telling me right. It's just lighting up one of those black, gray memory balls in my head.
I realize that I'm just taking Cujo from like the intimidation that's created by this character. But even before that, I'm trying to imagine a Cujo prior to this that wouldn't have been a horrible monster. And there's just nothing. There's nothing cute sounding about Cujo. It's just such a harsh sounding name.
Well, right, but people do name their dogs like Godzilla or Killer or something like that. So, and it is a big dog, so I could see a dick naming their...
Yeah. I was told about a cat, for example, that somebody in her family had that was named Boji. I'm like, well, where do you arrive at Boji unless it's mustard?
That's kind of soft and cute, though. Boji. You know, the J kind of softens it up a lot.
The J softens Cujo up a little bit.
The K sound is way harsher.
I understand what you're saying.
IMDb trivia. This is only a rumor, but Cujo, an ancient Indian word meaning unstoppable force.
Okay.
But I don't know that that's true. It just says rumor. But I guess the origin of the idea came from Stephen King actually had to go get his car worked on at some backwoods amateur garage guy.
Yeah, it feels like a lot of his stories are originated in his real life. Like Misery was something that was...
He writes about writers a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, maybe I'll have to read Cujo and make sure it doesn't suck. Because I was about to call him the anti-Michael Crichton. Like, well, because, you know, every movie that Michael Crichton has been based on his book, for the most part, aside from Jurassic Park, has sucked really, really
oh,
bad.
Oh, yeah, Congo is terrible.
Sphere.
Sphere is really bad. The Andromeda Strain is boring.
Well, the book's kind of boring, too.
Yeah, you're right.
But, yeah. I will take your word for it, and maybe I'll check it out and see how it holds up.
Timeline. That's another shitty movie.
Oh, man.
Now we can... Lost World. that book sucked, too, though.
Put your top five. Who's your top five?
Top five. Crazy, scary animals in movies. And I just moved away from the Facebook page, so that sucks. I'm going to go back and find that while I talk to you people to make it sound like I don't have to edit this out later.
We did have an Instagram submission, but it seems to have just been lost to the ether from Ian. Perhaps you could either give that back to us or magically it'll come back up while we're talking.
And if you deleted it for any purposes, that's fine too. But some Instagram is not showing it to us right now, and it kind of is frustrating. So I apologize for not reading yours on the air. We really only have one outside submission. Cousin Jeff at number 5, Cujo. Number 4, The Bat That Bit Cujo. Number 3, The Bat from Contagion. And 2, Church from Pet Sematary. And number 1, The Dogs with Human Faces and Nightmare on Elm Street 2. I'm assuming I'm reading yours, Josh.
If you don't mind.
Number 5, The Snakes from Snakes on a Plane. 4, The Killer Rabbit of, how do you pronounce that again?
Kanakapowna or something. I don't know. It's in a Scottish accent from Tim the Enchanter.
From Monty Python and the Holy Grail. 3, Jaws, Bruce from Jaws. 2, Cujo. Number 1, The Raptor Twins from Jurassic Park. And an honorable mention to several bears.
Yeah.
And a couple spiders. I'm with you there, though.
The arachnophobia spiders, man. I still haven't had Frosted Flakes, like 20 years later.
I've never actually fully watched that movie.
They're remaking that movie.
Isn't it kind of silly, like kind of funny?
It's supposed to be a comedy. It's like the most terrifying thing I've ever seen.
You could really make that movie super, even scarier.
Oh, yeah.
I had number 5, King Kong, Godzilla, and that stupid cat from Alien, which nearly got Ripley killed. 4, Gozer and Zool, I guess, from Ghostbusters, unless I'm screwing that up, because Josh called it something else. Vince, I don't know.
Oh, the dogs are different, but I just got that from Google. Google's wrong sometimes.
The Velociraptors from Jurassic Park, Cujo, number 2, and number 1, the shark from Jaws.
My list, I mean, I don't really have a list, but there are a number of, I could shout out, like Roar. Have you heard of Roar with Melanie Griffith?
Yes, that the lion.
A real movie with real lions that nearly got Melanie Griffith killed. And of course, obviously Cujo, we've talked about, is pretty incredible. Jaws is, of course, an all-time classic, but you got to talk about, in terms of, like, if you want a real dog movie, check out White Dog, Samuel Fuller. About a woman who adopts a dog that has been trained to kill black people. It's a bizarre movie for sure, but really uniquely accomplished.
Bizarre, especially because dogs are colorblind.
The movie is just what it is. I believe a part of the idea for they've taken the idea of that from Family Guy's taken that idea from that movie, and how Brian reacts to black people on that show is based off the Samuel Fuller movie, and then of course The Birds from Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds.
Oh yeah,
yeah. I was trying to come up with specific animals when I did mine, but yeah, that's a good one.
All the internet lists though. That I looked at, like 7 different lists, because I can't let these lists go, is none of them had The Birds on it. That's a way better choice than most of them.
Although The Bear from The Revenant, had you put that in your list, would have been a good one. You had it as an honorable mention. But
lots of bears. The same bear played many of those bears.
The Bear from Grizzly 2.
Didn't have that on there.
Have you not seen Grizzly?
Grizzly 2?
There's a Grizzly 2. I mean, it's not widely available. They didn't actually finish it, but George Clooney's in it.
I didn't see the first Grizzly, let alone the second Grizzly.
Him and Charlie Sheen.
What's the name of that documentary where the guy gets killed?
Oh, Grizzly Man.
Yeah, that's a good scary bear.
Yeah. That would make a good double feature with Roar.
Such a piece of shit. Stop playing with the bears.
Seriously.
Either that or put your camera up better so we can see. Hearing it's not enough.
Number 18 in 1988. Squeezed and pulled and hurt my neck in 1988.
Squeezed and pulled and hurt your neck in 1988.
1988, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, the only movie that came out this week.
Yeah, it's an incredibly successful film, around $150 million at the box office or so, which is a heck of a return for 1988 in comparison to this weekend, which Jurassic World got $150 million off the bat. But Who Framed Roger Rabbit was in the theater for a long time. I remember going to see this, like, 7 months after it had first premiered in the theater. It's directed by Robert Zemeckis, and obviously for those of you that haven't seen it, it's combining live action with animation. Bob Hoskins is the lead, plays a detective in the 1940s that's investigating. At first he's just taking pictures of an alleged affair, and then after a while he's helping the toon known as Roger Rabbit exonerate himself from a crime he didn't commit. This movie is a hell of a lot of fun. I remember loving it as a kid because Roger Rabbit is silly, and all of the toon things that happen are, of course, very silly and very in line with what we're familiar with from older Looney Tunes cartoons, Tom and Jerry, etc. In fact, many of those characters make their way into this film, like Porky Pig and Dumbo and Bugs and Daffy and Donald, and one of my favorite scenes between Daffy and Donald. This is a hell of a lot of fun. Reminds us of what we love about cartoons and also weaves in this noir-like story. Is it a great movie? I don't know. It really depends on how you look at it, but in terms of accomplishments for film, I'm actually surprised that this is one of the only types of movies like this since then. You've got the Looney Tunes back in action thing. There's
Space Jam.
Space Jam.
come on. Bill Murray, Michael Jordan, they don't do bad things.
but I really loved watching this week. I've always had a soft spot for Roger Rabbit and his voice. I know it could be very ingratiating on those that would be easily annoyed, but for me, it works well. I just love this movie.
I'll go even a step further. I think this is one of the best movies ever made. Oh. In all honesty, I think this movie is that level incredible. The attention to detail that Zemeckis has here, the level of influence that he takes, not just from animated movies, but from actual like 40s noir, like John Huston movies, for God's sake. That's the level of stuff that he's working with here. He's taking a story that would be Bob Hoskins is playing a character that could be just as at home in a Dashiell Hammett written film as it is here. There's a scene in this movie that gets a huge laugh from me every single time, but it is straight out of an actual 40s noir. It's him about to go into Toontown. He's looking down that tunnel towards Toontown, and the weight of what's happening is coming upon him. This is where my brother was killed. He's holding a gun, but it happens to be a cartoon gun. But the framing is classically like a John Huston, Orson Welles kind of shot. And to take that level of influence and apply that to this movie, the care, the delicacy that he takes in making sure that those genre pieces are there to underline this ludicrous over-the-top comedy, that is a remarkable attention to detail that just shows a genius at work. I wish Zemeckis had been smarter in the rest of his career, because after this, it's pretty much a precipitous kind of a downturn after this. This movie is, I think this is his, honestly, maybe his greatest movie, and I know that's saying a lot. I think this is the best thing he ever did. There's so many great things here, like the little attention to details in the animated stuff. When Roger goes to sit in Eddie's brother's chair, and there's dust all over the chair, his fingers, when he pulls it away, leaves behind fingerprints. I know that's a little thing, but it's that level of attention to detail is brilliant, and that is the mark of a genius filmmaker at work.
I guess it would make me want to rein you in a little bit is it's beyond influence. He's full-blown lifting scenes from like the Maltese Falcon and stuff. It's not just, which I love, it's fun. I love the movie. I think it's great. That's just, I guess I would, I don't know how to quite put it on the greatest of all time list, but I do like it. And it's a ton of fun. It's a great movie, but I mean, that's, which I was actually going to say, that's what I thought was so cool. I think the opening scene is like, or maybe not the opening scene, but there's a scene in that's full on the Maltese Falcon at some point, I think. I remember watching them close to each other, and it's almost the exact same scene.
Huh.
And I'm trying, it's like in an office or something like that. I think it's, maybe it's Chinatown. I think it's the Maltese Falcon. Anyway, it's a noir movie that he full blown lists, but it was great. It was hilarious. It was fun. It was really cool.
But I don't think he's just setting it up. I think he's legitimately, there's a legitimate love of the genre.
Oh, no, I agree
not,
with that.
He's not sending it up. This is not parody. This is,
no.
He's literally taking that to create something and heighten this.
Oh, I agree with that. I thought it was cool when he did it. It wasn't like hot shots. It was really neat and really cool.
I just, that's the only thing that would keep me from putting it on the greatest of all time. But I do think it's a great movie. A little bit dirtier than I remember, but it is.
Yeah.
But I do remember it being dirty, so.
Jessica Rabbit, she's just drawn that way. It's a kind of this weird thing where it's a cartoon, and as a boy, I'm not attracted to it per se, but I certainly I paid attention to it, okay? And it mattered because you couldn't, like, turn your eyes away, and all of a sudden, all of this buxomness that wasn't on screen for live action at that point in my life, I am paying attention to it if it's drawn. It made a big difference. And Kathleen Turner's voice as Jessica Rabbit, that's excellent casting. You can definitely pick that voice out of a crowd. Boy, it's a hell of a performance even in voice work. Another thing I wanted to say about this, it's good that you said attention to detail. That's something I wouldn't have come up with in watching this. When a tune kicks a human or makes contact with a human or vice versa, you can sense the physics of that actually working. A lot of times with CGI, there's some misplacement. You know, it just doesn't seem natural. It doesn't come across as natural. And watching it this week, I expected there to be bad special effects, per se. But it's not. It all seems to be very seamless. And I think that's very difficult to do, to get that kick to land on the tune and have it literally launch from that moment.
And that to me is why Bob Hoskins actually and legitimately deserved an Academy Award, if not a nomination. He deserved to win, honestly, compared to whatever else came out in 1988. Bob Hoskins is incredible in this movie. He could, as Eddie Valiant, he could have been in a 1940s noir movie. He's that good. But then he's also funny. He's dancing. He's telling jokes. He is so great in this. And the way he interacts with Roger, the talent that he has physically to make you believe that Roger's really there, that's Bob Hoskins as much as it is any of the animation.
You're going to hate to know that it was Dustin Hoffman winning that particular award for Rain Man.
More my point then that Hoskins should have won.
Kevin Costner. I'm still sticking with that one.
Fair enough.
But I don't disagree with anything he's saying.
We've had a good couple of weeks here with Bull Durham and Who Framed Roger Rabbit. To think that these were in the theater together at the same time, that's some stuff of history right there. And there's nothing else from 1988 this week. I can't imagine that there would have been.
Just returning to your point, though, about Jessica Rabbit, it was something I wanted to bring up earlier, but it kind of just escaped me. But there's a critic now named Anthony Lane for The New Yorker, and I don't know if you've heard about this particular controversy. I don't know if it's – I don't know if controversy is a weird way to put it, but he wrote a review of Incredibles 2 in which he spends a little bit too much time kind of describing Elastigirl in a way that people have been left rather uncomfortable by.
Okay, sure.
And that's kind of like, I can only imagine what his review of Jessica Rabbit must have been like based off of this. But yeah, there's a lot of people very upset. This led to actually Brie Larson to kind of rap film critics on the nose and say, you know, men need to get out of film criticism and we need more women in there. This is the way men are going to talk about animated women.
Way to go, Josh.
I thought that it was culturally relevant to mention Jessica Rabbit's curvature.
You have no idea how relevant it was going to be.
I did not. But Elastigirl is hot.
Oh, jeez. Oh, no.
We can make jokes and have fun with this. God. I'm glad you said that.
I was heightening it.
Very bendy.
Oh, man.
It works very well for her character arc.
And then you put her voice there. Anyway.
I'm attracted to women. I'm going to say it. Like, I won't say that there's anything bad about that.
And we say we're attracted to men, too. It's
Yeah. George Clooney is hot as shit and out of sight, right? Like, I wouldn't kick him out of bed.
No.
That's where I stop saying things, though, right now.
Next week, Sicario and Uncle Drew are coming to the theaters.
So our classic is Kazam.
Sicario 2.
Oh, because Shaq is in Uncle Drew. Yeah, it's not Blue Chips. It's not Space Jam.
You've done Space Jam 2 weeks in a row. Someday.
Yeah, our classic is...
Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. 99% sure Josh is going to hate it.
Oh, I'm 99% sure I will, too. That's why I haven't seen it up to this point. My thoughts on Hunter S. Thompson and reading what he wrote. But this film has such a very strong following to it that I think it's important to watch it.
As does Hunter S. Thompson. Of course,
And for those who don't know the connection, Benicio Del Toro is in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
But who needs connection anyway, right?
Everything's connected, Bob.
Quit connecting the podcast together. Our top five next week is top five hitmen or assassins, not hit women.
What about hit girl?
Hit persons.
Hit persons. Top five assassins, male
hit girl
or female.
Could be one of them in theory, yes. Right? Yeah.
I know my number one, but yeah, we'll get to it. But yeah, we'll get those posted up here soon. What else do we got? Oh, Patreon. If you want to be a Patreon supporter, ihatecritics.net/Patreon. This is the part in the show where we give them a shout out and a credit on the show. We'll start with Jason Bryant and Charlie Messing as our key grips. Our character actors, Josh and Christina.
I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Our special effect level, Corey.
May the Force be with you.
Our associate producer, Jason from New Mexico.
Everybody has to eat shaving cream once in a while.
And our movie stars, Dave Seavers and Uncle Jeff.
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Again, if you want to be a Patreon supporter and help support the show, ihatecritics.net/Patreon and get a credit on the show. Anything else before we wrap it up for the evening? All right, then. Also go to Apple Podcasts, subscribe, rate and review the show. We'll read the review on the air. Otherwise, we'll see you next week.
That ought to do it. Thanks very much, Ray.
And we're the three best friends that anybody could have. We're the three best friends that anyone could have. We're the three best friends that anyone can have. And we'll never, ever, 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 ever leave each other. We're the best three friends that anybody could have. I mean the three best friends that anybody could have. That's right, the three best friends.
Do you guys want to play Flick Chart?
Oh, yeah.
Do we need to put a movie in there or just play random?
I think Who Framed Roger Rabbit deserves to go very high in this list. It's not already.
We haven't done it too much. It has popped up on occasion, but not a ton. It's currently number 92, though, so that's not bad for our list. Who Framed Roger Rabbit or Kick-Ass?
Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
Agreed.
I might go Kick-Ass there, but I'm probably wrong. Who Framed Roger Rabbit or Shrek?
Roger Rabbit.
Agreed?
Yeah. Who Framed Roger Rabbit or School of Rock?
Roger Rabbit.
Yep.
School of Rock for me, but... Who Framed Roger Rabbit or Toy Story?
Roger Rabbit.
Toy Story.
Toy Story. Who Framed Roger Rabbit or Austin Powers in Goldmember?
Roger Rabbit.
So, yes.
Yes. Come on, let's go. Internet. Country internet. It's coming.
Who Framed... It's like the bullets, you know? It has to... The old bullets in Roger Rabbit needs to orientate.
That is one minor inconsistency. There's one thing that bothered me about Roger Rabbit, just if I may for a moment, is the one thing I had a problem with. He sees Yosemite Sam early in the movie as Sam is flying over the wall and lands in front of him. But then later on, and Sam doesn't seem to notice him, but later on, when he opens up his bullets, inside is a dedication from Yosemite Sam. He got that cartoon gun from Yosemite Sam.
He's been fired out of too many cannons. He doesn't remember anymore.
There, I said it. There's one flaw.
You're right, though.
That's a pretty big flaw, though.
It's one. It's the only one.
Who Framed Roger Rabbit or Fight Club?
Roger Rabbit.
Yes, agreed.
Fight Club. It is now 55.
That's all right.
I don't feel like it got enough of a chance, but
honestly, it would be in my top 50 for sure. After this week, it moved up a great deal on my list.
I mean, I like it, but clearly, I just named four I like better. So,
it's not nihilistic enough for you.
No, I mean, School of Rock isn't either. But
that's something that you'll have to bring to the show at some point. I haven't seen it,
it's not as good as I'm making it out to be, but.
So many people like it, though, and it's Richard Linklater, and yeah.
I can say there's no flaws in it. Okay. Less opportunity for flaws as well. Anything else, or you just want to be done?
You can throw some more out there if you want.
All right. Let's see what we got. Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade or Panic Room?
Indiana Jones, I guess.
Sure, I don't really have an opinion on that one. The Last Temptation of Christ or Traffic?
Traffic.
That's a movie I considered using for the Undisputed Classic this week is Traffic, but we've done so much Soderbergh lately, I decided to go against it, but in this case, it's Traffic.
Yeah, it's hard. I definitely would watch Traffic before Last Temptation of Christ again. Independence Day or Austin Powers and Goldmember?
That's tough. Because both those movies, I've started to kind of hate both those movies as time has gone on. Independence Day, I guess.
I'll go with Austin Powers.
I'm going to go with Independence Day. But I don't really care. Pinocchio, 1940, or Full Metal Jacket?
Full Metal Jacket.
Agreed.
Apples and oranges. Ocean's 12 and Fantasia.
Ocean's 12.
Agreed.
Yep.
Fantasia is pretty unbearable to watch. But it has the status as classic animation.
Sherlock Holmes 09, Analyze This.
Sherlock Holmes.
Analyze This.
Analyze This. 28 Weeks Later, Ocean's 11. Weeks is the sequel.
Yeah. Ocean's 11.
Ocean's 11.
I agree. Dude, Where's My Car or Munich?
Munich.
Yeah. Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 1, Stardust.
What's Stardust? I don't remember.
Matthew Vaughn film, Michelle Pfeiffer, Robert De Niro.
Harry Potter.
Harry Potter.
Protocol, 1984, or Death Becomes Her?
Death Becomes Her.
Interesting. That's a Zemeckis film I have not seen, so I don't know. And I didn't watch Protocol when we came upon it in 2014.
Did we watch Death Becomes Her on the show or no?
No, that's it's coming up in a year or two.
All right. Let's see what else we got. Just take Sean's word for it. Did Zemeckis do Used Cars?
Yes, he did.
That's his best movie.
Well, it's fantastic, yes. Once you consider Roger Rabbit, Used Cars, Romancing the Stone, Back to the Future, Contact, Castaway.
Hold on. The last two
kind of drop off. I know, but earlier we were like, after Roger Rabbit, it goes downhill. And I'm like, no. I'm going to just mention a couple to keep it in people's craw.
And Castaway is bad. It's a really great performance, but it's a bad movie.
Nah.
Hey, we're still recording here. Dark Knight Rises or Sword in the Stone?
Dark Knight Rises.
Agreed.
Bob?
I just want to hear you say it.
Dark Knight Rises.
There you go.
I guess that's the show then.